I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you use social media, you've likely seen heated online arguments, outrageous posts, or conflicting news about climate change.
It's just very prevalent that people will share emotionally exciting information that they find that isn't truthful. And there are lots of bad actors out there who want to share bad information.
Jennifer McCarron of the Sierra Club says reading this can make people feel confusion or despair. So she leads a team of more than 1,300 volunteers who are fighting back, not by arguing with online trolls, but by uplifting truthful content. Each week, her team sends a few accurate social media posts to these volunteer climate truth tellers and asks them to flood the comments. The volunteers share why they care about the issue or how it affects their own community.
This may seem small, but actually helps influence platform algorithms to boost the visibility on those posts and help ensure that good information gets seen by more people.
And it's an approach anyone can use.
Weighing in with positive, truthful interaction is important not only because of the social media algorithms, but because other people will see your comment. And then if they agree with you, but they don't feel like speaking up, they'll know that they're not alone too.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, an entire hour with Atif Kabirsi, Emeritus Professor of Economics at McMaster University. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Before diving in, a quick appeal. If you appreciate what you're hearing, help us out. Subscribe to the Green Planet Monitor at greenplanetmonitor.net. Now the news with Kylie Wong.
The Canadian financial sector is deeply involved in supporting Israel's unlawful occupation of Palestine, bankrolling Israeli apartheid and genocide in both Palestine and Lebanon. That's the finding of a new report released on April 9th by the Canadian group Just Peace Advocates. According to the report, over 100 Canadian financial institutions have invested $500 billion in Israeli activities deemed unlawful by the International Court of Justice and other human rights bodies. Among these, 11 Canadian pension funds, 8 banks, 7 insurance companies, and 85 fund managers. By investing in weapons and surveillance systems destined for apartheid Israel and in the plundering of Palestinian natural resources, these institutions are complicit in internationally wrongful acts, including the crimes of apartheid and genocide, the report's authors say. Disclosure gaps mean total investments are likely higher, they add. The Carney government must force Canadian corporations to divest, the report says. Canada's weather agency is turning to artificial intelligence. Environment and Climate Change Canada will launch a hybrid forecasting model this spring, based on both AI and traditional weather forecasting systems. According to the agency, the hybrid model is better at predicting extreme weather, like strong winds or heat waves, because it records small-scale details that pure AI models tend to miss. Ottawa has passed its strictest immigration legislation in decades. Bill C-12 tightens asylum rules, strengthens border controls, and introduces narrower eligibility requirements. The new immigration rules will improve system efficiency and integrity, the government says, but critics argue it limits access to asylum and could put vulnerable people at risk. Bill C-12 attacks the right of refugees and migrants, says Julia Sand, an immigration rights lawyer at Amnesty International Canada, in an interview with CBC News. It makes it harder for people to have their claims for refugee protection fairly assessed, so it puts people at risk of being deported to face persecution and torture. Fresh off a historic trip around the moon, Artemis II astronauts are sharing what it's like to journey deeper into space than any human has before. NASA astronauts Reid Weissman, Victor Glover, and Christina Koch, and Canadian astronaut Jeremy Hansen splashed down on Friday, April 10th, just off the coast of San Diego, after completing a 10-day mission circumnavigating the moon, the first such mission in 50 years. Being 200,000-plus miles away from home before you launch, it feels like the greatest dream on Earth, says Weissman, the Artemis II commander. And when you're out there, you just want to get back to your families and your friends. It's a special thing to be human, and it's a special thing to be on planet Earth. And that's the news.
Thanks, Kylie. Of words to describe the world we humans live in today, an age of colossal inequality, insatiable corporate greed, genocide, and other unspeakable crimes live streamed on social media, the collapse of international law, no one coming to its defense, not even its supposed Western guardians. Worried observers turned to Antonio Gramsci. Gramsci was a fierce critic of Benito Mussolini's fascist regime, jailed in 1926. The Italian Marxist died there in 1937. Gramsci's famous words live on. Summing up darker times, Gramsci could never have imagined. The old world is dying, he wrote, and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. Today, the GPM speaks about these dark times with Atif Kabirsi. Atif Kabirsi is Professor Emeritus of Economics at McMaster University. He joined the United Nations Industrial Organization in 1982 as a senior development officer, pursuing missions in Indonesia, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Sudan, and Egypt. In 2006, Kabirsi was appointed Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia. Atif Kabirsi has published extensively on economic development strategies, global trade, and regional planning focused on the environment. The GPM sat down with Atif Kabirsi for an extended conversation.
These are scary times.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nobody could have expected this. And what's going on is that we are in a very difficult time because the institution we used to have that at least gave us a chance to resort to international organizations whose mandate is peace and peacemaking and reconciliation, they're absent. The United Nations is anywhere but where it's supposed to be, and it seems like it has been emasculated, subjected to the incredible and vicious campaign that President Trump has taken, trying to replace it. I mean, this institute or this board of peace, whatever they call it, that they're supposed to deal with the Gaza situation, is an attempt on the part of President Trump to replace the UN.
And it's remarkable that in the midst of all this tumultuous, cataclysmic activity going on in the Persian Gulf, you've got world leaders calling for a lasting peace deal, and Erdogan said something to that effect, and Keir Starmer in Britain says lots of work needs to be done to achieve a permanent ceasefire. So there's a lot of work, and on and on and on. But nobody's talking about the fact that Israel and the United States' assault on Iran was flagrantly unlawful. It was a violation of Article 2.4 of the United Nations Charter. So obviously the fact that there's a conflict going on is a huge problem, but it seems to me that a more fundamental problem is that there is no more rule of law anymore. The United Nations Charter is just a dead letter.
Absolutely. I mean, what you're really saying is absolutely true, in the sense, as I was hinting before, that we are living in a world devoid of any institution or any arrangement or any system to at least enforce the international law and the Charter of the United Nations. No question about it. Israel went on an illegal war against Iran. Iran has not threatened anybody. And they were in the midst of negotiations trying to find a solution. The U.S. and Israel went on a campaign, very vicious campaign, destroying infrastructure and trying as much as possible to impose on the people of Iran heavy costs. I mean, there is no evidence that this Minab school, 174 girls were killed, was hit by a very accurate missile that they knew without any doubt that they were hitting a school of girls that were totally uninvolved. So the issue here is, to what extent are we going to continue to survive a world devoid of any institution or any mechanism that will bring about some accountability and the enforcement of international law so that countries cannot act with impunity and the complete disregard of what we consider to be the basic infrastructure and architecture of the world system of peace and justice.
And this quote that keeps on coming up Antonio Gramsci's quote, the famous quote from the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, "The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. This is the time of monsters." And so in the absence of any rule of law, any country that has the power to do so is free to act as it pleases.
I mean, it seems like our prime minister picked this Gramsci thing because he said that the old order that we used to survive under is no longer exists. And even the old order was one in which the superpowers may have pretended to be abiding by international law, but they were doing whatever they want. But today, the situation is markedly different in the sense that the President of the United States and some countries are operating and visiting incredible levels of violence on other countries without any regard to what they're doing is a crime against humanity, a crime against innocent people, complete disregard of international law or international humanitarian law. There is nobody to hold them accountable. There is nobody to ask them to abide by the law. And even if they ask them, the poor Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Guterres.
Antonio Guterres.
Yeah, I mean, he looks like he's speaking in the wilderness. Nobody is listening.
And the Security Council is completely neutered.
Totally. I mean, the United
Nations. Since this resolution 2803, I think it was, that created the Board of Peace. Astonishingly, I don't understand why Russia and China allowed that resolution to be passed. But since it passed, the members of the Security Council have effectively handed the responsibility for achieving global peace and security to the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So the Security Council is toothless.
Toothless and without any power. I mean, the issue is that they just met and they talk and they condemn and they vote. But honestly, the UN is neutered. There is no UN. I mean, one of the basic issues, I worked in the UN. I was invited to be on a committee that was tasked with reform. And the basic mandate of that committee was to reorganize the UN. And we found out very quickly, and didn't take much discussion, that part of the biggest or the most serious issue that the UN faces is the fact that it's a legacy from the Second World War, and the warring parties, which are the five permanent members of the Security Council, have this veto power. This veto power, literally, it is translated into, in the context of conflict among the East and West, is basically and fundamentally responsible for paralysis of the UN. And most of us at that committee felt that the way to resurrect, the way to re-empower, the way to rehabilitate, so to speak, the UN is to deny these countries this veto power. What we really should have is a situation where whatever is the basic mandate of the UN, no veto power should be exercised. This is the sine qua non of the UN, is peace and reconciliation and mediation. And they're totally absent. And in the way we are dealing with problems using the veto power, the UN is unable to work on anything. I mean, you want to tell me that this genocide that took place in Gaza and the genocide taking place in Lebanon and even the war in the Ukraine, we can do something, should we have done something. The UN is nowhere to be seen. And one of the major reasons is that the UN, if it was going to go and do something, it takes only one country, and Mr. Trump is so happy to exercise the veto power, he has completely scuttled, neutered the UN. He has no interest in any organization that can stand in his way of this complete disregard of international law and doing and exercising his bully politics. And maybe trying to profit from it. I mean, how do we know? The guy has proven to be extremely motivated by financial gains. And to a great extent, the world is hostage to his whims and choices. And there is no mechanism. There is no respect for international law. I mean, here, the International Court of Justice has issued verdicts to arrest Netanyahu and other people.
Well, that was the ICC. That was the International Criminal Court.
The International Criminal Court, but International Court of Justice, yes, was literally still might have not really come to an agreement or a verdict, but it was considering seeing how it could adjudicate the case against Israel and Gaza. But the ICC took a position and went and said that this is a infraction of international law that is definitely in contravention of the spirit and charter of the UN, and this a murder of civilians by the thousands, 75,000 probably more, exactly constitutes a crime, an international crime, a crime against international law, against international humanitarian law, against all the basic fundamental elements of the UN Charter, and that he should be arrested and tried. You know, he moves, comes to New York, goes to different countries, he's visiting everywhere.
Mr. Carney allows Netanyahu to travel from Israel to the United States through Canadian airspace.
Yeah, and you know, Canada, as a member of the charter of the ICC or IJC, had the obligation, the legal obligation, to implement the conditions.
Don't pound on the table.
You had to implement the conditions.
But the International Court of Justice ruled in July 2024 that Israel's occupation, 57-year occupation, is unlawful, and that advisory opinion was upheld by the UN General Assembly in September of 2024 overwhelmingly. Canada abstained, but the UN General Assembly resolution called on the occupation to end by by last year,
yeah.
And of course it hasn't ended. And countries like Canada, like France, like Germany, like Italy, like the UK, like the most powerful Western states, and the Arab states, Gulf states, are doing absolutely nothing to bring Israel's occupation to an end.
Yeah.
And in fact, the illegality of Israel's occupation has been completely distanced from the current situation, the current problem.
Absolutely.
That nobody is suggesting that the fundamental, the core problem underlying the conflict between Israel, USA, as I call it, and Iran,
yeah,
is this ongoing occupation of Palestinian lands. Nobody's yes. talking about that.
Nobody is talking. And unfortunately, everybody knows, especially these countries who have accepted the two-state solution, but what have they done for the state of Palestine? I mean, to a great extent, every time, you know, the Palestinians want to move towards a situation where they can exercise their inalienable right to self-determination, they can't. And nothing has been done. You see, there is also a very fundamental thing that we need to ascertain. Today, the war is no longer by U.S. against Iran or Israel against Lebanon. It's against all of us. We are all paying for it. You know, if you drive, you pay it in terms of gas. Farmers are going to pay it in terms of high cost of fertilizers. We might not have enough fertilizers or cannot be afforded. Farmers cannot afford it. They're going to be a major catastrophic food insecurity in the world. Helium is not passing, and this could might ultimately end up compromising our ability to use MRI and all this medical equipment. Today, we, the people of the world, are held hostage to the actions of Israel and Iran by imposing on all of us the illegal war they have created and the consequences that came out. And even if the Strait of Hormuz is opened and free flow, which is not, it would take months, if not years, in order to get it to operate as smoothly as it was before this onslaught and war.
And there's this idea that the global economy is resilient and it's robust, but it is anything but. It is indeed totally vulnerable to complete collapse. Does this surprise you as an economist, the breadth and scope of the impacts that this war is having, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz is having on the global economy?
No, I'm not surprised. Actually, I'm surprised that people are not recognizing that the consequences are far more serious than this. Okay, I give you one example. In the Gulf, which has a population, I mean, I'm talking about Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, their total population, they call the GCC countries, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries. They have a population of 56 million. There are 35 million of this population are basically people from all over the world, but primarily Asians, South Asians, Pakistani, Indians, Lebanese, Palestinians, Egyptians, who make their life and livelihood from that area. And now, with the paralysis that we are having in that Gulf, the livelihood of these people is threatened. And this can ultimately mean poverty, greater indebtedness, depreciation of currency. And we are all also suffering two consequences under the name of two things: unemployment rising. Even in the Canada, we talk about our unemployment is 6.7%. But in Toronto, it's 7.6%. And this is what we call the overt unemployment. If you look at disguised unemployment, maybe the unemployment rate is much higher. We are paying it in terms of our kids not getting summer jobs, our brothers and sisters not getting jobs, our friends are being laid off. Our children are unable to acquire a home or pay the rent because the interest rate on these mortgages is now sky high, and it could even go higher. And these are not independent events. They are all natural consequences of the incredible situation that we face today, and this huge debts that are really being assumed because of destruction and because of high military expenses. Even Canada, I mean, our prime minister is increasing the military expenditures. And military expenditures, everybody know, they do not create jobs. They're basically, and to a great extent, they are capital intensive, and we tend to import them from other places, so we don't get the job. They also really implicate the government in huge deficits that would prevent them and would curtail their ability to spend on social programs, on health, on unemployment benefits. So to a great extent, there isn't a single one of us that is not affected by this war. And we have no voice. We have no way of registering our dissatisfaction, unhappiness, and prevent it from continuing to impose these incredible costs on us.
Are Russia and China a threat to the West?
You see, my worry is that, you know, the U.S. is exercising very overtly and very destructively its military power. The Chinese and the Russians, Russia is embroiled in the war in Ukraine, but the Chinese and the Russians have not shown any real muscle or dissatisfaction or objection. They make declarations, they abstain from voting, but one would have thought that to some extent, the presumption is that Iran is their ally. What have they done for Iran? How, you know, you say, oh, we're supplying huge amount of weapons and things. The world is today far less safe, far less legal, moral, whatever word you want to use, that would make people exercise their inalienable right to peace and justice and living in harmony. We are all being targeted. We are all paying for it, and we are totally powerless at trying to cope with it.
Because, I mean, I ask the question because Western leaders present the challenge that we all face in the West and in the world as being constituted by this threat from China and Russia. It's this competition that they put forward as being the primary threat and the challenge that humanity faces, rather than climate change, rather than inequalities, rather than injustice, rather than the degradation of the rule of law. And so everything is kind of based upon, like in Western Europe and in Canada, looking towards Europe, that the major challenge is rearmament, and it's building up our capacity to engage in permanent war. It's the permanent war economy. And so this is why I asked this question. I mean, you know, is China the primordial threat that Western leaders suggest it is? I mean, set Russia aside for a minute.
Not really, you see, but my worry, and I'm sure, David, you agree with me on this, in the sense that now the U.S. is setting an example that if I have power, I do what I want. What will prevent China moving and claiming Taiwan? I mean, we have completely allowed illegal and self-imposed strategic or military objective to go undisciplined, unaccountable for. So to a great extent, China today is not representing a threat, but it could. And the U.S. is setting an example and creating the conditions that, okay, China, if you want to do something, you have the power, do it. There is no legal system. There is no standard UN charters or any accountability system. And this worries me is that today China is not doing much. Russia